This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen to it.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I'm very pleased to have as a return engagement my dear friend, brilliant analyst Dennis Camino. We're going to talk about the book Nobody Died at Sandy Hook and the vicious attacks that have been launched upon it by trolls and shills trying to drive away the public's interest. But before we turn to the book, I want to take you back in time to an event that occurred on 14 December 2012, namely the press conference that was held by Wayne Carver, the medical examiner for the state of Connecticut, who, in my opinion, was the linchpin of the entire event. If you had not had a medical authority of his stature, I think very few would have been willing to believe what they were being told, at least. His authority stood behind the claims that were being made. So let's start with this short clip of Wayne Carver. This is like 4 to 5 minutes out of a 15-minute interview you can find online. But let's see what Wayne Carver has to say. Pay attention to his demeanor, his manner, and what he may be holding in his right hand as we look at
if you can control the situation, depending on your photographer, and I have very good photographers, but no, I don't.
How young?
Sorry, I don't.
How young was the youngest victim?
Sorry, I don't.
How young was the youngest?
How young? Sorry, I don't. How young was the youngest victim?
And I believe everybody except the assailant and his mother will be finished tonight, and I'll do those tomorrow morning. Anything else on here?
No, sir.
No. And our, I think a lot of our there. They're up all on the second floor, and I didn't get there today.
Sir.
And it's my sensibilities may not be the average man. It's a good thing it's not being prosecution, because then I couldn't answer that. But all the ones that I know of at this point were caused by the long weapon.
So the rifle was the primary weapon.
Yes.
And what caliber were the?
Question was, what caliber were these bullets? And I probably know more about firearms than most pathologists, but if I say it in court, they yell at me and don't make me answer. So I'll let the police deal with that for you, the injuries.
But you said it was the long rifle that was used?
Yes.
But the long rifle was discovered in the car. That's not correct.
Not correct, sir.
Follow up on that question.
I don't know. There were lots of them. Okay. Y'all going to have to look at the spreadsheet when we pass it out. I'm sorry.
Did the gunman kill himself with the rifle?
No. I don't know yet. I'll examine him tomorrow morning.
Precision from the shooter, or was it spread sort of randomly?
Both. It's a very difficult question to answer. Okay. You'd think after the thousands of people I've seen shot, I could answer that question, but it's If I attempted to answer it in court, there'd be an objection and they'd win.
They're wearing
kid stuff.
Doctor, the children that you autopsied, where on the body were they wounded?
All over.
How many boys and how many girls?
I have no idea. It's H. Wayne, W-A-Y-N-E. Carver, C-A-R-V-E-R. And it's the second. And that's why I don't use the H, because when my father asked my grandfather, he said, fine, but as long as you never call him Harold. It wasn't a tent. It was this magnificent thing. We have three vehicles and a lot of guys to drive them. Actually, one of the highlights of my administration is that we make them as nondescript and unmarked as possible. It's to foil you guys.
Self-inflicted, that means you don't have evidence.
I just...
You don't know.
I
you haven't checked it yet.
It wasn't a tent. It was this magnificent thing. No, I don't.
How young?
Sorry, I don't.
How young was the youngest?
It's amazing to have to say so, but you're watching one of the great frauds and hypocrites of our time. The man is even betraying the Hippocratic Oath, which declares that you should do no harm, because by virtue of his role in this, the fear was instilled in the hearts and minds of parents across the nation, the very idea the young man would come into an elementary school and shoot up 20 children, 6 adults, after murdering his mother was horrifying. And I'm here to say that this man belongs in his own hall of infamy for his performance here, which I will demonstrate today for those of you who do not already know. He was part of an elaborate charade, a phony, fake, elaborate, a drill that was presented as though it were a live event where no children died. The school had actually been closed by 2008. The whole thing is disgusting. Dennis, don't you agree this man was actually the pivotal player in conveying the public image of Sandy Hook and make most people think that, well, it must be true?
I have to tell you that he played a very, very important role in the deception, because unlike a lot of the other events that we've had that have taken place afterwards, where they didn't really have a credible centerpiece to interview like this gentleman had been, they really had to come up with a real anchor that could be where people would focus on, because it would all come down to how can we not believe this? We have a coroner here talking about these deaths, but the thing that's very hard to get out of my mind is how he was talking about the wounds to the children. He was being very vague. For a man that had just allegedly examined dead children that had been shot very brutally, with very closely spaced shots, fundamentally to the face and to the head, he really leaves a lot to your imagination, and that's one of the key and fundamental parts of the psychological operation or the gladio nature of the terror that the U.S. federal government is foisting on the public by making the parents and the whole nation in the aggregate be able to visualize children slaughtered in wholesale fashion, brutally shot with a great deal of precision, which is very unlikely, but to talk about it even further, with a lethality rate that exceeds what professional trained soldiers would be able to achieve. So without this gentleman standing up in front of the press, making, basically the point that this is a real event. I'm up here to tell you about the nature of the wounds and the fact that these children every single one, fatally shot within a very short period of time without any hope of being resuscitated or able to be operated upon to save their lives. If they didn't have this man, I think in the very early hours of this game, they would have lost a great deal of credibility because they captured the psyches of tens if not hundreds of millions of Americans who envisioned this horrible scene that, for all practical purposes, we know now was nothing more than a script. And a very horribly twisted and demented one where people in the core of Central Intelligence Agency and Mossad and other government agencies like the Department of Justice, for instance, all contrived to deceive and fool the American public and put the whole nation on a very unsure footing where virtually everyone would be looking for these wide-eyed, crazy, maniacal faces leaping out from around every corner, wielding a weapon and just nonsensically shooting people to death. And that was the intent of this whole entire thing. And if you look how very carefully that they manufactured the artificial facial characteristics of the shooters, not just this one, but the ones used in Tucson and Aurora and perhaps even earlier shootings before that, what they have done is they have made virtually anybody that looks even remotely just a tiny bit unusual into a wholesale mass murderer that could leap out from anywhere at a school or a public place, as the SPU shooting in Seattle, which is another fraud and hoax, that these people lurk everywhere, under every nook and cranny, wielding a weapon ready to murder innocent people at will, without a real motive. And ostensibly we have people like Michael Rivero, who will explain this phenomenon away in a fashion where they claim that serotonin uptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, over-the-counter medication for depression, are the fundamental reasons why regular human beings are capable of taking many, many lives with a great deal of accuracy. But we've had SSRIs on the market for more than 30 years, 40 years now. Many, many people have had the opportunity to have them prescribed. And yet, until this incident came to pass in 2012, this hoax, virtually there was nothing in the press about large numbers of people being murdered by people on SSRIs until you have these apologists make it plausible that crazy, maniacal next-door neighbors or young children, allegedly who were given firearms training by their mother, of all people, could leap out into your life and end and terminate mass numbers of human beings' lives without even a real core motive. So when we had this coroner get on the screen and explain to people that this is actually had occurred, now what we have done, or what he has done, is he has cemented the plausibility of this type of event into every single human being that even remotely believed it was possible that this kind of killing could occur. But like I said, there has been no evidentiary basis to link the usage of SSRIs, which I believe are reprehensible and wrong anyway, because they're used primarily to give people a drug to take for virtually everything. If you feel like you might have a small problem with being a little bit depressed, of course your psychologist is going to put you on something like Paxil, or which, by the way, has a horrifying withdrawal. Other serotonin uptake inhibitors that for a very, very long time, your brain chemistry is altered to the point where you're virtually nothing more than, an anesthetized zombie where you don't even really have very much free will. Now, to morph that into somebody that can be used as a wholesale killer, in a mass murder scenario like they foisted on us over and over again since Sandy Hook, no, I'm afraid not. This is not what, you can't explain this kind of nonsensical behavior without any motive, without any driving force behind it. And yet Wayne Carver, in his first appearance, really did make the case that, yes, this is possible. This is, horrific, nasty, unbelievable death can be meted out by people that have no predilection to violence, by people that are incapable of probably aiming a firearm of this nature or the alleged nature with the degree of accuracy where the kill ratio would be upwards almost 97-98% of virtually everyone shot, which is absurd.
Was killed. Virtually everyone shot. Every target he fired at was killed. Yes, virtually.
That's right. And there was no possible way that any of the people could have possibly been clinging to life enough to where an EMT could go in there and go, look, we've got a pulse. Let's get this one on the helicopter. This whole premise is absurd and ridiculous and nonsensical. Yet, I have to tell you even today as we speak, even with a lot of people catching on to the unbelievable banality and criminality of this government to stage such unbelievable and mind-blowing, examples of hubris is this. It goes way off the scale, but yet Americans were willing to believe that there would be no EMTs ushered into that school immediately to find anyone that may possibly still have a pulse, get them on a helicopter, get them to the hospital, and save a life. But no, they wait till way into the evening, and then they evacuate the corpses to wherever they took them to. But this whole thing is preposterous. And this man, as you've stated, was a pivotal and key part of the ruse and the deception and the lie that allowed so many gullible, and I have to tell you, quite stupid and ignorant Americans to believe that, yes, a very young gentleman that was, autistic and had severe problems with dealing with reality. Yes, Asperger's syndrome could fatally shoot so many people in such a short period of time. I mean, the whole thing is completely nutty. Yes. Whoever wrote this script, by the way, fell very heavily on their sword, but yet it still worked. In other words, the only thing that he didn't do is have Barney the purple dinosaur singing a ridiculous song behind him while he's shooting, and then somehow writing that into the script.
Let's look at the next slide, the back cover, while you continue to make these points, Dennis, because there's a list of them on the right. Proof it wasn't a massacre was there. No surge of EMTs into the building. No medevac helicopter was called. No string of ambulances to the school. No evacuation of 469 other students. No bodies placed on the triage tarps. I mean, you'd think it wasn't in a medical emergency at all, Dennis.
No, there's no sign of anybody having had any contact with blood. Just in the same, very same fashion that the Tucson hoax shooting quite a long time ago wrote the article Nexus of Tyranny about, was completely staged with the assistant to the lady who was allegedly shot in the head at moderately close range by a very powerful pistol, that there's no blood on the hands of the man that allegedly had to apply a pressure to the head wound to suppress bleeding. Now, I mean, we've got a photograph in that article that shows a fake cup of blood and a FEMA coach kneeling and reading what appears to be a 3x5 cue card, but yet all of these visual clues that nobody has been really shot in the head. There's no blood at Sandy Hook. I mean, you would have at least seen one person in this whole entire crowd with a glove covered with blood. I mean, there would have had to have been somebody that went into the building and ascertained that, yes, there are dead in here, and yes, they've been fatally shot. But there's not one sign of any person present on the scene that even has a remote tint of red on their hands. And I don't care what how you're going to try and explain that away, but somebody would have come out of that school with blood on them. And there would have been, you know, for the amount of bleeding that would have taken place, they would have had blood tracked out of that building in such copious amounts, you would have seen it all over the floor. You know, it would have come all the way out to the doorway where allegedly every single officer went through a small hole to get into the building in the first place. I mean, come on, folks. You know, you talk about, you know, gullibility and stupid. This is the epitome of gullibility and stupid when nobody questions the fact that in Tucson, there's nobody with blood. There's no sense of urgency on the part of the people evacuating the lady in the on the gurney, taking her to a hospital, allegedly. One gentleman appears to be looking at a stopwatch because they obviously are timing things to make sure that they fit inside of the criterion for doing it right. But if you look at every single person in the face in that photograph, there's nobody that's focused on the woman that's been shot. Everybody is looking everywhere but where she is at. And in a situation like this, there would be people with a great deal of worry looking at the potentially fatally wounded lady on the gurney. Nobody is doing this. I mean, clue after clue, sheriff's deputies with bottles of water in their hand. The list is unbelievable what they get away with at these things, and they stage it, and nobody questions anything.
We have considered in the past that the judge was the real target, and the most recent report I have read about this suggested that a photographer there had actually clubbed him on the head to kill him, and that that part of the event had been edited out of the official footage, which wouldn't surprise me at all, Dennis, if it were true.
Well, I have to go so far as to even question the fact that the judge even existed in the first place. I mean, I'm going to take a real wild swing at this one and tell you point blank that, you know, the same defense is used over and over and over again by the people that are defending these hoaxes, saying, what about the people that allegedly weren't killed? Where did they go? What happened? We have a photograph in one particular case, probably not included in anything that we portrayed here, where the actual shooting victim is standing at his own funeral. I mean,
these things
are so absurd and so ridiculous. You know, in case after case after case, we saw photographs of these guys all with blue backgrounds behind them, you know, showing the alleged shooters. I mean, come on. There's so many coincidences that they should raise the hackles on the back of everyone's neck the moment they clue in on the fact that they've been taken for a ride down the rabbit hole, and yet nobody seems to be seeing any of this. Go ahead.
Those who study the front and the back covers of the book, of course, will appreciate that I am loading it with evidence that is indicative that things are completely amiss, such as showing the iconic photograph on the back left that went around the world, and then a second photograph, which I now believe was probably taken first chronologically, where they're actually rearranging the kids to get the better shot, Dennis. I mean, how bad is that?
Well, it goes even further in the fact that off to the right-hand side of that photograph are two gentlemen with their arms crossed across their chest.
Oh, yeah, we got half a dozen parents there. Let's go to the next slide, number three. It turns out that actually the book is getting a fair amount of publicity. This is from DC Clothesline, airing out America's Dirty Laundry, which actually is one of my favorites. So I was very pleased when a post by a blog by James Tracy was published there about no one died at Sandy Hook. It wasn't a school massacre. It was a FEMA drill, including the proof it was a drill right before our eyes, the sign everyone must check in. Boxes of bottled water and pizza cartons, porta potties present from scratch, many wearing name tags on lanyards, parents bringing children to the scene, plus, of course, all the points I made indicating that it wasn't a massacre. And now, of course, we know, Dennis, those fall into two distinct groupings because the first five pertain to the rehearsal, which was conducted on the 13th, the second five to going live on the 14th, where we even have the FEMA manual that talks about everyone must check in. It says restrooms and refreshments will be provided. Dennis, we have so much evidence on this. I can't believe anyone could continue to deny that it was an elaborate hoax.
Well, it's not so much of you know, rational people making these denials. It's the progenitors of this Gladio, the people that desperately need this to work to disarm the American public and to make the American public throw up their hands and go, yes, take the guns, get them out, take them all. These very same people that so fear the guns are the very same people, like Gene Rosenberg, the FEMA employee, that crisscrossed the United States of America for months before this event took place, talking about gun control and, you know, and arms confiscation. We also have, you know, one of the key players here, the alleged mother of one of the victims, who apparently spent a great deal of time working for gun control issues at the United Nations.
That's right. That's supposed to be the mother of Noah Posner, whose purported father, he calls himself Lenny Posner, has done everything he can to sabotage all the efforts to expose the hoax at Sandy Hook. I trust he's being well compensated for that, because he's one of the most disgusting individuals related to any of this.
Right, and he's much more disgusting than many, because somebody, whether it was him or one of the people in the government themselves, fabricated the death certificate for a killed child to the point where they used so many fonts and types of print in the fabrication of the fake document that it goes beyond absurd. And yet they swear that this is a real event. Time after time after time, we have overwhelming, incontrovertible proof in photography, in statements, in witness accounts, and including the government's own fakery that they used, you know, including the use of green screen technology at CNN, where they staged the alleged interviews at the scene, where it was all done inside the studio itself, where they weren't actually literally at the location. I mean, my goodness, you know, the first thing that I mentioned over and over again, it's a no-brainer when you talk about the fact that if you look at the parking lot, every single vehicle is parked nose to the building. This is not possible on a normal school day.
Nose away from the building, Dennis. Oh, yeah, nose to the building. Both of the parking spaces, right, where they shouldn't be parked nose away, they're parked nose toward the building, yes.
That's right, and virtually nobody parks like that during a normal school day. They would park vehicle nose to nose in the parking spot vehicles arrive.
Right, right.
And the other thing that's painfully clear is you see virtually no fresh oil on the tarmac in the unoccupied by vehicle portions of the parking lot.
Which
very, very, very clearly shows that this parking lot hadn't been used for a very, very long time.
Now, Dennis, I want to get to the attacks on the book, but in getting there, I want to just demonstrate how we know that Wayne Carver was a perp at the heart of the matter. Let's look at the next slide, number 4. This is fascinating and completely devastating, in my opinion, because it's early in the morning. The SWAT team is already there. If you look just above the front of the SWAT team, you can see 4 windows in a row in classroom 10. Which are decorated with the drawings of candles, which incidentally are virtually the only Christmas Hanukkah decoration here. I mean, this is the 14th of December. Christmas is around the corner. For our little kids from kindergarten through fourth grade, there should be Christmas decorations, Hanukkah decorations everywhere. Instead, this is before anything has taken place. There are some vehicles in the foreground, Dennis, that are pointed toward the school, precisely as you observed. Look at the flag. It's at full mast. Look down straight below the flag, just slightly to the right. That is Wayne Carver, MD, standing with his arms crossed, waiting for the arrival of his portable tent. And look, you can see crime scene tape is already up. Nothing has happened too early. Kids wouldn't have even arrived if it were actually an operating school, which it was not. But, I mean, this just shows we caught them with their pants down. Now, here's another photograph. Look at number 5, slide 5. This is a close-up, so we can see him better. There's Wayne Carver. You can see the police tape. You see these people in the blue suits, the blue uniforms are there to set up, do the fine tuning before the event. And let's now go to the next slide, number six. And you see, not only is Wayne Carver there, but he has a cane, and the cane is lying on the wall just to his right. He has his cane lying there. My last guest, Scott, noticed this when he and I discussed some of these slides, because he wanted me to provide more distinct images of Wayne Carver, which I was glad to supply. And he noticed quite astutely that Wayne Carver's cane was there as well. Here's one more, number seven now of Wayne Carver there. Or if that's one we've already looked at, turn to number eight, where you can see from an aerial view now. This is later on in the day. But notice Wayne Carver in the lower left, his cane is still there on the wall. It's different, a different arrangement. Now, of course, the event is purportedly already taken place. So, you know, the police tape would now make sense when it didn't make sense earlier because nothing had taken place. Here's yet another image of Wayne, a close-up where you can see the cane very, very distinctly. And Dennis, would you believe, Scott also noticed that in the following, when he's doing his press conference to which you alluded, there's a cane right in the middle. Right in the middle there, he's got the cane. And in this one further image, number 11, you can see it even more distinctly, the handle of the cane he's holding in his right hand. And just to complete these photographs that are so devastating, in number 12, we see the pink rods extending from the alleged bullet holes, except, as you see at the lower right, they were drilled by perps. They drilled them. And we actually have other photographs that show the aluminum expanding into the school. But notice now it's damaged. Notice below the bullet holes, the window's broken. Here you see a bullet hole there, all part of this gigantic fraud. And in slide number 13, further proof. There you have in the upper left the entryway that Adam Lanza allegedly blew out for him to come into the building. But look at the lower right. The crime scene tape is up, and there are a couple of the perps inside the lobby making final arrangements, but the window is not blown out yet. So what can we say? How could anyone argue with proof like this, Dennis? It just dumbfounds me that there should be anyone out there who would deny the kind of powerful, overwhelming, detailed, thorough proof we have that this was a hoax, and it turns out that Wayne Carver was the linchpin.
Well, you know, as pivotal as his role was, you know, we also have other players that that even go even further as far as the degree of complicity, including the Attorney General of the United States. And the governor of Connecticut, Mr. Malloy himself, who at his press conference talked about the fact that he had had a discussion with the attorney general who warned him that something of this nature was going to happen.
Dennis, he did not identify by whom he had been spoken to. He simply said he had been spoken to, and that led me to figure out by whom, and that it had to have been the attorney general who arrived there on the 27th to talk about Project Longevity, which is a gun control project, and it's clear that that was the person by whom he was spoken to. But he did not identify the attorney general at that point in time, Dennis. I think that would have been very, very alarming, that many antennae would have gone up had he actually identified by whom he was spoken to.
Well, it's almost as, you know, we have to go even to these other hoaxes that were staged in other locations, such as Tucson and Aurora, where when you talk about the chief of police at Aurora making a statement to the public, and right in that very same crowd, right on camera, we have an FBI agent we identified as Mr. Iacone of the Federal Bureau of Investigation smirking and smiling at such a grave event. I mean, you know, the type of things that these guys do and the fact that the Department of Justice is clearly pivotally involved in not only the execution of these hoaxes, but in the planning and the setup of them and the aftermath, coaching people on how to deal with the press at these things, You know, if Malloy would have said, yes, I spoke with the Attorney General, I don't know if it would have been any more of a shock than the fact that, that we don't really know specifically that that was who he was speaking to. But,
well,
you know,
there's no other option than that it was the Attorney General. And when he said something like this might happen, there are only two choices, namely that someone was going to go crazy, go into a public school and shoot up a bunch of kids, in which case the governor, having been given that warning, surely should have advised the school districts to increase their security to ensure it did not happen, which, however, the governor did not do. Or alternatively, he had been told they were going to take an abandoned school. They were going to conduct an event and claim that an actual shooting had taken place when it had not, in order to promote a gun control agenda. And, of course, that's exactly what they did.
Right. And the thing is that they had done it successfully before the Sandy Hook thing. And the one point that that we need to probably make, and even though it's a little bit out of sequence here, is very shortly after the Sandy Hook event took place, that a piece of legislation was passed tucked into the National Defense Authorization Act that came very shortly after in the following year, early months of the following year, that effectively gave the government carte blanche to propagandize and stage these hoaxes without
yes.
any fear of legal retribution.
Yes, you're talking about the nullification of the Smith-Mutt Act, which precluded the CIA from using the techniques of disinformation and propaganda within the United States it used abroad, and which was part of the National Defense Appropriations Act for 2013. You're absolutely right, Dennis.
And the thing that's really important here is that a lot of people that we're talking to in the audience do not remember the 1970s in Operation Gladio, where the Central Intelligence Agency staged very, very horrific events in Europe, much in the same way that they put these together in the United States, for the implicit reason of making sure that the European governments all absolutely positively increased the American troop presence on their soil to fight the Red Brigades, who were allegedly going around kneecapping people and murdering people. All of this was done by Central Intelligence Agency in the 70s. This is a very old technique. It's been honed to a fine science. However, the United States population, almost to the last man in this country, has no idea that this very same government is a master of this kind of deception to get the kind of gun control agenda going and rolling in this country, to where at some point in the near future, the United States president will stand at the podium after signing an executive order, perhaps, and declare that guns will be confiscated. That is the goal. Gladio achieved its objectives in Europe. Gladio in the United States, possibly, as I speak, is obtaining the objective of conning the public into believing that every gun is waiting to spring up in the hands of a maniac in any place that you can imagine, by a wide-eyed, goofy-looking person with orange or pink hair that could be around any corner ready to hose you down with hot lead. That's what they want the public to believe, so that they'll willy-nilly give up their right to bear arms. Now, this is a very scripted thing that they're doing.
Now look at the next slide, because it reflects the fact, also from DC Clothesline, that, and also from James Tracy, that there's been this mass of negative reviews attacking the book. Dennis, now, it seems to me very clear cut, because you have, you know, a whole host of 5-star reviews and then a whole host of 1-star reviews. The difference being, those who gave it 5 stars have actually read the book. Those who gave it 1 have not.
Of course, because there's no way that any of those 1-star reviewers, had they even cracked it, could possibly deny the overwhelming, incontrovertible evidence in this book. We're not talking about 1 or 2 photographs or 1 or 2 statements or offhand observations of obscure details. We're talking about things that absolutely, positively, beyond any reasonable person's doubt, prove beyond any reasonable doubt that the United States government and the Attorney General of the United States, the President of the United States implied also by virtue of his actions, all conspired to deceive the American public with the end goal of taking the guns away from all of us. That is clear here. And it's very, very clear that every single one of the critics, if they would have even cracked the book for 15 minutes and speed read it, they would have had to put it down and walk away from their agenda, because they would have seen that the overwhelming evidence in this book absolutely eviscerates their argument that there's no content here that's true, which is the statement made over and over and over again, that the people that wrote this book and created it were delusional and need of mental health care. Every single allegation that they make is unsubstantiable. They have nothing to back it on. And they talk about all lies. The whole entire book is lies. The people that wrote this are sick and they're inhumane. That is absurd, given the incredibly, you know, bulletproof, I have to say, and it's maybe a bad term here to use in this context, evidence that proves that everything that we say is true, everything that we say is absolutely backed up by fact, every allegation that we've made about the guilt of these conspirators to deceive the American public is airtight. There's no jury in the United States of America, unless they had lobotomies, could possibly find for the government and support the fact that this hoax event took place, given every single fact that we have in the book.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Dennis. And of course, they perform all kinds of straw man arguments by exaggerating circumstances to make it easier to attack. They write and attack me as though I were the sole author, as though this were a monograph, when we have about 20 essays, we have six PhDs, retired or current professors, we have six other experts, including yourself, who are featured here. I mean, the amount of intellectual resources is overwhelming. I myself had published 30 articles about Sandy Hook, but I'm way behind Dr. Ewan, who has the Forum Fellowship of the Mind, who has published more than 80, Dennis. I mean, these are some of the best, most highly qualified students to ever take on Sandy Hook. And you're absolutely right. It is dismembered piece by piece until there is nothing left.
They don't have anything. They haven't even begun to crack even one of the assertions that we make, or any photograph that we have produced, including these very damning photographs of the people staging the iconic photo. In the same photo, by the way, photo of the series, by the way, there's an officer standing at the school with his arms folded across his chest, facing the parking lot with his back towards the hazard, which would be a very unsecured building, potentially with more shooters inside of it. And yet he's showing his back to that to look at the parking lot with his arms folded over his chest. I mean, there's more photographic evidence that there was no emergency at the school. And furthermore, that the date that they said that this took place was not the date that they took the photography, because there's not one single person in that conga line that they shot twice blowing any frost. And on that day, the temperature was so cold that virtually every single person would have had steam coming out of their faces, and yet not one person does.
Right. And
that's
in the
inexplicable.
Background. And there are too many leaves on the trees. There's no frost on the ground. And the point you make about breath is impeccable. And in the larger view, you have a string of parents with their arms folded or hands in their pockets looking on as though they were going to be passive bystanders at a child shooting massacre. I mean, it's absurd, Dennis. If there had been a shooting, how could the parents have got to the scene so fast when they're doing this evacuation, this staged string of about 15 students? We know that there should have been 469 others to be evacuated. But when we look at the dash cam footage for the locations in the parking lot and the time specified by the police, there's no one there. There's no evacuation taking place. And the explanation, of course, is that's because there were no children there to evacuate, because the school had been abandoned by 2008 and was being used for storage.
You know, if they had to, Jim, I'm going to make this statement right now. If they had to, they would have called every police asset in several counties to come and evacuate students from that school if they couldn't get the buses there to do it. But they didn't do this. I mean, there was no mass student evacuation in any way, make, or form. That's a statement of fact. We have Gene Rosenberg, the female employee who allegedly had these children in his home for quite a long period of time because somebody was so goofy that they would leave these children in the custody of a person that they really didn't really know.
According to the story, a bus driver left these five or six students with Gene Rosen, even though he's not their parent, he's not their custodian. He took them in, he claimed, and gave them milk and cookies, and they played with stuffed animals. He said he'd heard the shooting, but he hadn't called the police. His whole story is completely preposterous. He is one of the real rotten eggs in this whole business, too, along with Wayne Garber. But they have a very large supporting cast, Dennis.
Well, of course, and the fact that nobody wants to talk about it is the fact that this man's real name was falsified in every official record about this event, because his real name is Rosenberg, not Rosen.
And he is a female employee. He actually is a member of the Screen Actors Guild, Dennis.
He's a very poor actor. It's very apparent when we have video footage of him walking around in circles like a winged parrot.
Let me say about the attacks. I mean, the first reports from persons who had read the book, of course, were giving it 5 stars. So they went into gear to drive it down and began posting a whole string of 1-star reviews, each of which had a single sentence. It was very obvious none of them had read the book. There were other 5-star reviews, but it drove it down from 5-star rating all the way down to 3 or even slightly below. And now, since it's become well known what's going on here, there have been quite a few now very, very fine contributions to the discussion, Dennis. There are a couple reviews there that really blew me away. There's one by a school teacher that I knew struck you very positively today.
Yes, and I read that, and every single point that this lady makes is very on point. In other words, I'm gonna read to you exactly what she said in the latter part of her review. This is what the woman said. To me, such a sad commentary on where our country is headed. You know, I mean, just so disgusting. And now I have lost all trust and faith in our government, media, and what they push out front and center is big issues for our country. I look out at these innocent faces each day that I teach, and I think, what world are we leaving these kids? Let's get it back to where government and media that work for the people, not the other way around. What has happened to the moral compass of our country? When did seeking the truth become a horrible thing? The corruption is growing so rapidly, infiltrating everything. That is a scathing indictment about what the moral turpitude of the United States of America is today, when its population will withstand this kind of obvious hoaxing and not be absolutely furious about it.
And it's stunning how many
this woman makes.
And it's stunning how many were complicit. I mean, you got these fake parents pretending to have dead children. You got some persons who claim to be their fake teachers, one of whom, this Caitlin Roy, claims to have stuffed, you know, a dozen kids into a little tiny room that couldn't possibly... It even opens in, the door opens in rather than out. I mean, it's about as ridiculous a story. One positive sign, Dennis, is that she has published a book, and it has been savaged. I mean, there's one review after another taking it apart because her story is not just fantastic. It's complete fabrication. But then you go up to the state police where this Lieutenant Paul Vance was threatening anyone with prosecution if they disputed the account being issued by Connecticut State Police, and it goes up to the governor, and all the way to Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States, and Barack Hussein Obama.
That's exactly true. We have photographs of him with allegedly dead children sitting on his lap, and it's debatable when the photograph was taking place, but don't you think it's awful prescient that he has a potential casualty sitting on his lap for a photo opportunity?
Well, that was after the event. That was when he went out to comfort the survivors. And the identity of the little girl, is disputed as to whether it's supposed to be her younger sister, but it's bizarre that she's wearing exactly the same clothing that the purportedly dead older sister was wearing. But it is a very bizarre photograph, Dennis. I'm glad to say, as our last slide reflects, that the reviews are making a difference. And there's a period here earlier when we had 45, where there were 69% had given five-star reviews, 27 one-star. In other words, the many more reviews are coming in now. I can't believe anyone would give it other than a five-star if they were sincere. And I was therefore astonished that there was 1 4-star and 1 3-star. The 3-star was very peculiar. I think it was out of concern, because this is somebody who claims they have friends who actually had children who died there, and therefore he's torn between the evidence being presented in this book and what he's being told by people he knows. And I wrote to him and I said, because he thinks people actually did die. And I wrote and I said, read the book. I said, the school was closed by 2008. There were no students there. And consequently, no students could have died because there were no students in the school. Dennis, you know, people have a hard time with dealing with the consequences of facts when they're established. I mean, once you understand the school was closed by 2008, you know, what is left to argue about?
Well, there's nothing left to argue about. The thing that's really, you know, I got to tell you that you can't, the only way you can really explain away the denial of the American public to want to believe that this took place is that they do not want to handle the fact that they were so egregiously lied to and conned. They can't handle the fact that the government is so corrupt and so illegitimate that it would stage this kind of gladio terror with the intent to get everybody to want to throw the guns at the government and say, here, take them. You know, the American public is very gullible, almost unbelievably so. But what's even worse is their immersion in cognitive dissonance, where the real problem is that they know deep down in their very cores that this is absolutely taking place, but they can't admit it to themselves because it kicks the chair out from underneath their stupid foundation, their Pollyannish, exceptional American country that would never do this kind of stuff to get the guns away from the people.
Well, bear in mind, Dennis, you know, most good, hardworking people just don't have a lot of time to devote to anything like this. They accept what they hear from the mass media. The duplicity of the mass media is simply overwhelming. We have a recent report from a reporter in Germany that all the news is fake. All the news is fake, which is consistent with the report attributed to William Casey as director of the CIA, that our disinformation program will be a success when everything the American people believe is false.
Those words should have been emblazoned somewhere on the rear cover of the book to remind people what the end goal has always been.
Well, they're on the back cover of the Moon Book, Dennis. Those words are on the back cover of the Moon Book, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either. But let me just talk here about the cover just a minute, because I believe in, you know, presenting the evidence up front. You got a photograph, aerial photograph of the school at the lower right. And then you have that early morning photograph on the upper left, the one we've already looked at, where actually Wayne Carver is present. And in the upper right, you have those triage tapes that were there just for effect because no bodies were ever placed on them. In the lower left, you see the men, the perps, who are drilling the holes in the windows of classroom 10. In the middle photo on the right, you see perps inside the school prepping it. And on the left, you see who appears to be an imaginary creature of fiction, namely Adam Lanza, who is alleged to have perpetrated all of these events. Dennis, the scenario is so bizarre, it's difficult for anyone to get their mind around it until they face up to the fact that we have a mountain of evidence to prove it.
Well, the real problem here is that if you look at history, all the way back to the most heinous acts in criminality in recent minds, going back even 40 years to the 1960s, for God's sake, when you look at all of the evidence about the motive, you know, where is the motive? Where is the motive? What they have done in these gladio hoaxes in the United States of America is disconnected all possible motive from the act. In other words, you don't need a motive to commit mass murder. All you have to do is have a weapon, and then you'll automatically do it because SSRIs. You're on serotonin inhibitors. If you got a gun, you're going to go out and kill and kill and kill. That's the whole message that the United States government wants these websites out there that are actually making this kind of banality and ridiculousness look like it's plausible.
Would you believe that on the 16th of January, 2013, just a year and 2 days after the alleged shooting massacre, Barack Obama signed no less than 23 executive orders to regulate gun control in the United States, in spite of the fact that as president, he swore an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, the Second Amendment of which he has been systematically subverting?
Well, I'm gonna say something that's gonna really piss off a lot of people, but that man has never read the United States Constitution, ever. Because no person that could ever possibly have read it could so egregiously violate it day in and day out, worse than the predecessor that he took the helm from. And I'm gonna tell you something, we've had nothing but evisceration of our civil liberties since 9/11 on forward. And it's just been one act after another and another. If you really want to roll the clock back, it's been nonstop for a great many decades.
Dennis,
it accelerated after 2001.
Dennis, I can't thank you enough for being here. Those who want a recap about 9/11, go back to the Real Deal 103 on who was responsible and why, where Dennis and I discussed 9/11. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking Dennis Camino for being here. Stand by for the new JFK show.
We can now
with Gary King, Larry Rivera, Donald Fox, will be
that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Less than 3% of you people read books, because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything, that didn't come out of tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off the television set. Turn them off now. Turn them off and leave them off.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
He's muted. He's muted.
Yeah, he's muted.
Welcome to the new JFK show number 79. We're going to have a continuation of last week's show, and you can learn along with us. This is really the bottom of the rabbit hole, and we're going to talk about Permadex and Israeli involvement in the JFK assassination. I'd like to welcome Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Rivera, Don Fox, and myself, and James George in the engineer's chairs. All right, let's get it underway there. Go ahead, Don.
Okay, Chance, do you have the PowerPoint loaded? Okay, awesome. All right, so we can fill 20 seconds here. I caught the tail end of your show there, Jim, with Dennis, and I saw some of those emails today. And I tell you, the Amazon.com, I always cringe when I see those reviews because I spent so much time there on the Judy Wood, you know, the Where Do the Towers Go, your review of it.
I don't know if you noticed, but Emmanuel Goldstein has come on there to attack me there too.
And I'm sure. I just like
on James Tracy's blog, which is entitled memoryholeblog.com. She is as disgusting as they get, Don.
Yeah.
Go for it. Let's not dwell on the despicable. Let's go for the truth about JFK.
Okay. So, no Emmanuel Goldstein, on our show tonight. So, we will discuss Permindex. People hear the term Permindex in JFK research and they're like, well, what exactly is it? What was it? Was it a front? You know, what was it supposed to be in real life? You know, what was it? What was its purpose? How does Clay Shaw fit into all this stuff? Why did Jim Garrison prosecute this Clay Shaw character? Where did he fit in? Nobody accused Clay Shaw of ever being in Dealey Plaza or, wielding a gun, or he's not a tramp. You know, why pick on him? What did he do? So those are all, good questions, especially for people that are maybe a little, newer to the case. So let's start out with, I thought maybe a good place to start tonight's show. Carrie and I did a show earlier in the year on Permindex, and we're going to use some of that material here tonight to go over it again. But I thought maybe, we'd start out with, just our friends over at Wikipedia. I thought we'd get their little article on Permindex just to kind of lay the groundwork for, they're good at putting out the official story of things. So what's the – back a slide there, buddy. Okay. So what's the official position on Permindex? Okay, so here's from Wikipedia. Permindex, also referred to as Permanent Industrial Exposition, was a trade organization – headquartered in Basel, Switzerland. Permindex was described as a holding company built with Canadian, Italian, Swiss, and U.S. capital. As of 1960, it had 20 stockholders. In 1959, former Prime Minister of Hungary, Ferenc Nagy, said to be the president of Permindex, outlined the group's plans to build, quote, Europe's first international shopping center for businessmen, unquote, within the previously unfinished Espo Zizone, Universal Roma, and my Italian's a little rusty tonight here. Permindex occupied 400,000 square feet within four palaces under a nine-year lease with another nine-year option. The project was modeled after and designed to compete with the International Trade Mart New Orleans, which Clay Shaw was a part of that as well, I believe. And the center opened on January 16th, 1960. Yeah, businessman Clay Shaw, head of the International Trade Mart in New Orleans, represented the United States on the board of directors for Permindex. On March 1st, 1967, Shah was arrested and charged with conspiring to assassinate President John F. Kennedy by New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison. 3 days later, on March 4th, the Italian left-wing newspaper Passé Sera published a story alleging that Shah was linked to the CIA through his involvement in the Centro Mondiale Commerciale, a subsidiary of Permindex, which Shah was also said to be a board member. According to Passé Sera, the CMC had been a front organization developed by the CIA for transferring funds to Italy for, quote, illegal political espionage activities, unquote, and had attempted to depose French President Charles de Gaulle in the early 1960s. On March 6th, the newspaper printed other allegations about individuals it said were connected to Permindex, including Louis Bloomfield, whom it described as, quote, an American agent who now plays the role of businessman from Canada who established secret ties in Rome with the deputies of the Christian Democrats and neo-fascist parties, unquote. The allegations were retold in various newspapers associated with the communist parties in Italy, France, and Soviet Union, which was Pravda, as well as leftist papers in Canada and Greece prior to reaching the American press 8 weeks later. American journalist Max Holland stated that Passé Sera's allegations connecting Shah to the CIA eventually led Garrison to implicating the CIA in a conspiracy to assassinate Kennedy.
Max Holland, by the way, is well known as a stooge for the government.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this is a Wikipedia article, so that's what we're going to get. And according to Holland, an internal investigation by the CIA's counterintelligence staff found that Shah had volunteered information to the agency's domestic contact service from 48 to 56, but that the substance of the allegations were not true. It concluded that neither Permindex or Centro Mondiale Commerciale were a front to channel funds to anti-communists, and that the agency had not solicited Shah to use his relationship with CMC for clandestine purposes. And yeah, as you say, Holland is probably just a government shill. So that's kind of the thumbnail. It's the stated purpose, the public purpose of the organization.
That's the official apology about Permindex, exonerating it from any involvement in the assassination of our 35th president.
Correct. Yeah, you can go to the next slide there, Chance. And yeah, the cover story for Permindex was that it was just a trade exposition. That's what they used to call it. Like, they would have them go from city to city. But this one was supposed to be permanent, so that's why it was a perm index, you know, not just a temporary 2 or 3 week thing. It was supposed to be a permanent industrial exposition, kind of like a big trade show. You know, various business people could hawk their wares, and that's what it was meant to be. But of course, underneath the surface, we've got drug running, you know, gun running, guns, drugs, money, hitmen, you know, the whole shot. So, okay, so then my two big sources for this stuff were Salvador Astuccia's Opium Lords, Israel, The Golden Triangle, and the Kennedy Assassination, and then Michael Collins Piper's Final Judgment. And then I found a couple of articles on the internet from Piper that I used here as well. So let's start out with Astuccia's take on Clay Shaw. So in 1967, New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison prosecuted New Orleans businessman Clay Shaw for conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy. Garrison suggested in his book, On the Trail of the Assassins, that Shaw received instructions from Louis M. Bloomfield. In addition, Garrison discovered that Shaw and Bloomfield were board members of two trade organizations, Permindex and Centro Mondiale Commerciale, both expelled from Italy in 1962 for subversive intelligence activity. So if everything was on the up and up, why were they getting booted out of Italy in 62? Clay Shaw was a tall, distinguished man with silver hair and a polished manner, born in Kentwood, Louisiana on March 17th, 1913. During the 1930s, he worked in New York City as an executive for Western Union Telegraph Company and later as an advertising public relations consultant. By 1963, Shaw had become a wealthy real estate developer in New Orleans. He was director of the International House, the World Trade Center, quote, nonprofit association fostering the development of international trade, tourism, and cultural exchange, unquote. Researcher Jim Mars wrote in his renowned book about the Kennedy assassination, Crossfire, that the following description of Shaw's military background. By 1941, Shaw was with the U.S. Army, and while his official biography states simply that he was an aide-de-camp to General Charles O. Thrasher, Shaw later admitted he was working for the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, the forerunner to the CIA, as a liaison officer to the headquarters of Winston Churchill. It was here that Shaw may have become entangled in the murky world of intelligence. Although there is precious little reliable information on exactly what Shaw's wartime experiences included, he did retire from the U.S. Army in 1946 as a major. Later, he was made a colonel with the Bronze Star, the Legion of Merit, France's Croix de Guerre, Belgium's Order of the Crown. And it is significant that Shaw received France's Croix de Guerre while serving as a colonel in the U.S. Army in the 1940s. There is strong circumstantial evidence that Shaw may have also served as a colonel in the French espionage organization. Service de documentation extérieure et de contre-espionage, or the SDECE, under the aliases of Colonel René Bertrand and Colonel Beaumont. So even though my French is not that hot, the big takeaway out of this was that's where Shaw started using these aliases.
Hey, Don, I just wanted to ask, do you have a photograph of this Bloomfield guy? You know, he seems to have been quite a major player in this whole scheme here, you know.
Yeah, I do have a photo of him coming up here in a
few slides.
Yeah, so we'll get to him. I figured we'd hit the big players first, the Clay Shaw, the Jim Garrison.
Well, you mentioned him at the beginning, and I was wondering if you had a picture of him, a photograph.
Let's not forget about Clay Shaw. He was actually the arresting officer of the rocket scientist Von Braun. In fact, he was responsible for bringing over a large percentage of the rocket scientists from Germany.
Right, Operation Paperclip.
He was highly decorated by the French, the British, the American Army. So Mr. Shaw was no slouch. However, he was just like everyone else. It was all about running guns and running drugs for the mighty Israel.
That's correct. Okay, Chance, you can go ahead and go to the next slide here. And okay, so here we have our esteemed Mr. Garrison. And it says here, Jim Garrison proved that Clay Shaw often used aliases Clay Bertrand or Clem Bertrand. Danish journalist Henrik Kruger wrote in his 1976 book, The Great Heroin Coup, that a Colonel René Bertrand, alias Colonel Beaumont, worked for SDECE in the 1940s. According to Kruger, Colonel Bertrand used his influence in 1949 to get French gangster Joe Atiyah's prison sentence reduced from life to only 4 years. Atiyah had been convicted in France for illegal possession of weapons and involvement in the death / murder of another gangster, Pierrot Lefaux. I'm sure I butchered that pronunciation as well. Atiyah had saved Colonel Bertrand's life during World War II and eventually asked Bertrand to return the favor by getting his sentence reduced. Given that Clay Shaw was a colonel in the U.S. Army in the late 1940s, that he admitted to working for the OSS, and given that he was awarded France's Croix de Guerre, and given that Shaw resided in New Orleans, which has a strong French heritage, and given Shaw's known propensity to use aliases, it is possible that French SDECE officer, Colonel Rene Bertrand, right, alias Beaumont, was actually Colonel Clay Shaw. This missing link about Shaw's background connects the dots to many of Jim Garrison's discoveries about Shaw's past, his links to international espionage, and his involvement in the assassination of President Kennedy. In addition, Henrik Kruger wrote that Colonel Bertrand, alias Beaumont, is one of the names most associated with SDECE espionage involving assassination, kidnapping, and other notorious scandals. I believe this is from Mike Piper. And so he says that Permindex, in reality, was a Mossad arms trading and money laundering venture operating in conjunction with the Lansky Organized Crime Syndicate. And Clay Shaw, a longtime CIA asset serving on the Permindex board, was a prime player in the New Orleans phase of the JFK assassination conspiracy. So therein, quite simply, lies the key to the mystery behind the JFK assassination. Therein lies the explanation as to why Jim Garrison's investigation of Clay Shaw, a director of Permindex, had to be scuttled. Not only had Garrison stumbled upon a definitive CIA link, but he had also inadvertently discovered the Israeli connection. But at the time, Garrison himself never even suspected how deeply the Permindex nexus went. Garrison had only come across the tip of the iceberg. Okay, that was from a Michael Collins Piper web article that I found about a year ago. And, okay, you can go to the next slide. So here is the Banque Internationale de Credit, or the BCI, or BIC, I think, if you're in France. English is, I think it's BCI is how it's referred to as. The fact is that when New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison prosecuted trade executive Clay Shaw with conspiracy in the assassination, Garrison had stumbled upon the Mossad link. Although after his acquittal, Shaw was revealed to have been a CIA asset. In 1963, Shaw served on the board of a Rome-based company, Permindex, which was actually a front for a Mossad-sponsored arms procurement operation. A primary shareholder in Permindex, the Banque de Credit Internationale of Geneva, was not only the fiefdom of Tibor Rosenbaum, a high-level Mossad official, but also the chief money laundry for Meyer Lansky, you know, quote, chairman of the crime syndicate and longtime Israeli loyalist. Chief executive of Permindex was Louis Bloomfield of Montreal, a top figure in the Israeli lobby and an operative of the Bronfman family. Intimate Lansky associate and leading patron of Israel. Permindex was clearly the Israeli link to the JFK assassination, so much so that Jim Garrison himself later circulated the manuscript for an ever-published novel in which he fingered the Mossad as the prime mover behind the conspiracy, although Garrison never otherwise mentioned a Mossad connection publicly.
Hey, Don, can I just interject something here real quick?
Sure.
Before the JFK assassination, Permindex had a hand in the De Gaulle assassination attempt.
That's right. So assassinations, yes.
Yeah, so much so that Permindex and the Mossad were kicked out of France after that attempt. After that attempted hit, so yeah,
they got booted out of Rome too. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, also, could Clay Shaw, could he have had some kind of involvement in the De Gaulle plot?
That's a distinct possibility. I haven't heard that per se, but I think a lot of the people that were involved in the De Gaulle were also involved in Kennedy. It's also like the General Walker. I think the people involved in that were also involved with the Kennedy.
So a lot of the bankrolling for the assassinations came from Permindex. This is where a lot of the money was laundered, and the assassination teams were financed through this company, Permindex.
Yep. See, Permindex was allegedly just a trade expo, so it could freely, you could put it in various cities around the world, and then now you've got your whole money laundering and gun running and, you know, the whole shot going on. And then eventually the host country figures out what's going on and boots them out, but
Yeah, when they figure out that they're doing a little assassination work on the side to help pay the bills.
Yeah. Most cities aren't real thrilled with having Mossad front operations, you know, in their midst. So once they get discovered, they get the boot. Okay, Chansey, go ahead and go to the next one here. So this will take us to our guy, Meyer Lansky. Him and his brother Jake were the big Israeli mafioso, or the kosher Nostra, as they're often referred to as, which I think is a good term. I kind of like that. So central to understanding the joint Mossad CIA Lansky organized crime syndicate nexus in the plot to assassinate John F. Kennedy is to recognize the importance of a little explored corporate entity based in Rome known as Permindex. New Orleans businessman Clay Shaw, indicted by Jim Garrison for conspiracy in the JFK assassination, served on the Permindex board of directors. Many assassination researchers have contended that Permindex was a covert CIA money laundering operation. Shaw, of course, did have ties with the CIA. Others have put forth the theory that Permindex was a front for a Nazi remnant left over from World War II. This theory, exciting though it may be, falls far off the mark. All of the Furman evidence indicates that Permindex was an Israeli operation with close CIA connections and tied inextricably with the Meyer Lansky organized crime syndicate. Unraveling the mystery of Permindex explains the web of intrigue that ties all the key players in the conspiracy together. The Permindex connection is also the famous French connection to the JFK assassination. And as we shall see, the French connection is actually the Israeli connection. Permindex was a Mossad arms trading and money laundering venture operating in conjunction with the Lansky Organized Crime Syndicate. And Clay Shaw, a longtime CIA asset, serving on the Permindex board, was a prime player in the New Orleans phase of the JFK assassination conspiracy. Therein lies, quite simply, lies the key to the mystery behind the JFK assassination. Therein lies the explanation as to why Jim Garrison's investigation of Clay Shaw, director of Permindex, had to be scuttled. Not only had Garrison stumbled upon a definitive CIA link, but he also discovered the Israeli connection. Okay, I think we... Yeah, that was from page 247 of Final Judgment. Okay, and then let's go to the next one, Chance. Okay, so the Mossad. So according to Meyer Lansky's sympathetic Israeli biographers, after Israel had become a state, almost 90% of its purchases of arms abroad was channeled through Rosenbaum's bank. The financing of many of Israel's most daring secret operations was carried out through the funds in BCI. BCI also served as a depository for the Permindex account. So that Tibor Rosenbaum's BCI was a controlling force behind the enigmatic Permindex entity, places Israel and its Mossad at the very center of the conspiracy behind the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Clay Shaw's positioning in New Orleans, site of one of the operational rung of the conspiracy, resulted in Shaw's implication in the investigation conducted by Jim Garrison. But the conspiracy went much deeper. Ultimately, as we now know, Garrison came to recognize that Israel's Mossad was intimately involved in the events in Dallas on November 22, 1963. However, in the beginning, Garrison surely never even suspected and certainly had no reason to do so. JFK's secret war with Israel was an unknown factor in the geopolitical events of the period. Attention instead was focused on the American involvement in Southeast Asia. Okay, then we can go to the next slide here and we can look at another wholesome character in this tale, Guy Bannister. And this is taken from pages 420 and 421 in Final Judgment. What most people don't know is that Bannister's best-known right-wing associates, Kent and Phoebe Courtney, were staunch supporters of Israel and widely suspected of being assets of the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, of B'nai B'rith. The truth about the Courtneys puts a new light on the Bannister connection to the CIA assassination conspiracy. After Bannister's death, at least a portion of his personal files came into Kent Courtney's possession. And why is that significant? Many veterans of the American right generally believe that Kent and Phoebe Courtney were active infiltrators of the right wing or paid agents of the ADL, the American intelligence arm of Israel's Mossad. And those are some folks that I think everybody here has had a run-in with it one time or other. I know Jim and I have. Although the Courtneys were, like Bannister, outspoken anti-communists, they had engendered much distrust and dissension among their fellow conservatives by actively opposing and attacking figures on the right who had been accused of anti-Semitism by the ADL. Perhaps the most notable and most readily documentable instance of this came in 1960, when a wide-ranging group of American conservatives were gearing up to form a third party to compete in the 1960 presidential election. Prior to that meeting, Mrs. Courtney sent out letters to some 30 different persons and organizations advising them that they were not welcome in the so-called new party meeting. All of those in question targeted by Mrs. Courtney were persons and organizations that had been scored for anti-Semitism by the ADL. But Mrs. Courtney's action, needless to say, created much controversy among conservative circles, and in the February 1960 issue of Right, a clearinghouse for news and viewpoints in the right-wing movement, Vern P. Kaub, the president of the American Council on Christian Laymen, released, quote, an open letter to Phoebe Courtney responding to her allegations that haters, or so Mrs. Courtney alleged, had infiltrated patriotic organizations for the purpose of creating dissension. There were widespread rumors within the right wing that not only were the Courtneys financed by the Stern family of New Orleans, but also that Mrs. Courtney was related to the Sterns. Paquita, and I'm sure I'll butcher this, the Shish Marif, a veteran right-wing leader, was among those who believed this to be true, but there were many others.
As far as the Stern family, they were the ones that owned WDSU TV Channel 6, and they were responsible for giving Jim Garrison his response after allowing the nationwide hit piece by Sheridan and company. So,
What TV station was Oswald doing that debate on after
his? The Stern family owned WDSU TV Channel 6 in New Orleans, right there in the French Quarter, about a mile from here.
Yep, so Oswald was handing out leaflets in front of Guy Guy Bannister's office stamped on him, and then he ends up in a TV debate was it an anti-Castro Cuban? In this, So you can tell Oswald was their boy, you know, going way back. Okay,
hey, Larry, can Larry hear us?
Yeah,
Larry's still there.
Yeah, Larry. Yeah. Do you remember who it was that Oswald had the debate with on Channel 6?
Carlos Bringier.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, my buddy.
I've met him several times, huh? Can't get
He doesn't want to talk to me.
Imagine that, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, Chance, you can go to the next slide here. And here is the, in quote, Mr. Bloomfield. Here's the picture of him.
Okay.
Yeah, here's a poster. You know, I found this on Google Images. Recognition of China Now. So Bloomfield was over in China, and then he came back, and he was, they were pushing for free trade with China way back in the 60s.
And they got their man Nixon to push it all the way through.
Yep. Yeah. That's how long this stuff takes. It takes, you know, that's who we're up against, and they're patient. They keep at it and keep at it. Okay, so let's talk about Mr. Bloomfield there for a little bit. So Louis M. Bloomfield, based in Montreal. Bloomfield was a longtime intelligence operative and frontman for the powerful Bronfman family interests. The Bronfmans were not only key international backers of Israel, but also longtime figures in the Polanski crime syndicate. Bloomfield, one of the foremost figures in the Israeli lobby in Canada and one of Israel's leading international operatives, not only served as the chief shareholder in the Perm Index Corporation, on whose board of directors Clay Shaw served, but also had intimate ties to American intelligence. So yeah, this is page 252 now of Final Judgment. Above all, the Perm Index connection to Israel and its global intelligence network is best personified by the individual who served as chairman of the board of Perm Index, Major Louis M. Bloomfield of Montreal, Canada, a devoted and influential supporter of the Israeli cause. It was Bloomfield who held half of the shares of the Perm Index and its parent company for party or parties unknown. In fact, Perm Index had its headquarters in Bloomfield's base of operations in Montreal until 1961, at which time it was relocated to Rome. Beyond question, Bloomfield, as we shall see, was a major player in Israel's international network. Bloomfield played a critical role in helping establish the State of Israel and its Mossad. In the years that followed, Bloomfield rose high in the ranks of the Canadian business world, reputed to control Le Credit Suisse, Bank of Canada, Heineken's Breweries, Canscott Realty, the Grimaldi Ciosa Shipping Lines Limited, and interestingly enough, the Israeli Continental Company. But the real key to understanding Bloomfield is his role as a founding partner in Phillips, Feinberg, Bloomfield, and Goodman firm, which represents the Canadian-based Bronfman family interests. This rather intriguing detail suggests that Bloomfield's wide-ranging financial interests were, in fact, those of the Bronfman family. Thus, Bloomfield was essentially a front man for the Bronfman Empire. And you can go to the next slide, and we will now we'll discuss Rabbi Tibor Rosenbaum, one of the godfathers of the State of Israel and the first director for finance and supply of for Israel's intelligence agency, the Mossad. Rosenbaum was a prime financial angel behind the Perm Index Corporation and a key figure in the JFK assassination conspiracy. His Swiss bank, the Banque de Credit Internationale, also served as chief European money laundry for Meyer Lansky, chief of the global crime syndicate. Lansky's primary link with Israeli intelligence and financial operations came through the entity of the Banque de Credit Internationale in Geneva, Switzerland. This bank emerged as Lansky's primary European money laundering operation. This bank was the brainchild of one Tibor Rosenbaum, an Orthodox rabbi. Rosenbaum served for a period as international vice president of the World Jewish Congress, of which Lansky connected Bronfman family member Edgar Bronfman has served as president. Rosenbaum was also a co-founder of the World Zionist Congress and a director of the Jewish Agency in Geneva, Switzerland. However, and most importantly, Rosenbaum had served as director general for finance and supply for Israel's secret intelligence agency, the Mossad. Now, Rosenbaum was very clearly a key figure in Israel's international intrigue and a critical player in the world of organized crime syndicate boss Meyer Lansky. Rosenbaum, among other things, also served on the board of the Swiss-Israel Trade Bank, established by Pinchas Sapir, Israel's finance minister and a Mossad officer. It was during the time he served on the Swiss-Israel Trade Bank that Rosenbaum created the Banque de Credit Internationale, or BCI. Investigative reporter Jim Hogan focused on the Lansky-Rosenbaum connection and its central link to Israel's intelligence operations, particularly those of the Mossad. During the Second World War, Rosenbaum had become a hero of the resistance through his underground activities on behalf of the Jews. After the war, he became a delegate to the World Zionist Congress in Basel, where plans were made for the creation of Israel, and worked in various European capitals for the Palestine Liberation Office, a forerunner of the Jewish Agency. This wasn't for Palestinians. It was for Jews to liberate Palestine. It was at the height of the Zionist terrorist attacks in Palestine that, so we can kind of guess who was behind some of those terror attacks before Israel actually became a state. A superb clandestine operator, Rosenbaum is said to have been instrumental in providing weapons to the Haganah and Stern Gang. That would tend to explain why his international credit bank, BCI, Rosenbaum's baby, became gambling czar Meyer Lansky's number one conduit abroad. Rosenbaum was more than a friend to the Jews, however. When his bank was rocked with scandal after the collapse of Bernard Kornfield's IOS, the newspaper Haaretz solemnly declared, "Tibor Rosenbaum is Israel." And the paper wasn't far from wrong. While Rosenbaum's bank facilitated the flight capital schemes worked by IOS, it also served as a source of secret funds for the Mossad, Israel's intelligence service, and as one of the country's primary weapons brokers. So that's Rabbi Tibor Rosenbaum. And then if we go to the next slide, we'll see Mr. Bronfman here in action. As we can see, he's standing up at the platform and giving a speech in front of the World Jewish Congress, or a press conference. And this is from an article Piper wrote on American Free Press. This is actually right after Edgar Bronfman died a couple of years back. The patriarch of crime syndicate-connected empire that has operated in the sphere of the Rothschild dynasty is dead. On December 22nd, 2013, Edgar N. Bronfman, a longtime head of the World Jewish Congress, or WJC, died at age 84. A New York Magazine once described him as a, quote, sometimes coarse, bullying businessman, unquote, but noted, there are some people who would simply call him King of the Jews. Rabbi Michel Zion hailed Bronfman as a modern Talmudic Jew, noting that Bronfman's favorite book was the Babylonian Talmud, the hero of which, the rabbi admitted, is not God, but the, quote, cunning human scholar, unquote. Praising Bronfman's work, funding scholarships for Jewish youth, the rabbi said Bronfman was, quote, the person who invited us to live Talmudically in the modern world, unquote. This recalls Meyer Rothschild, the founder of the dynasty with whom Bronfman's family had a long association. An admiring biographer once said that Rothschild was a zealous believer in the Talmud and chose it alone as the guiding principle of all of his actions. It is thus fitting that Bronfman biographer Peter C. Newman said the Bronfmans were the Rothschilds of the New World, estimating in 1978 that Bronfman assets totaled some $7 billion. In fact, Edgar Bronfman had a level of clout few could claim, precisely because of his frontline positioning in the Zionist movement and his family's pivotal historic role in the crime syndicate. Edgar was the son of Sam Bronfman, who immigrated to Canada from Russia and made his fortune in liquor, gambling, prostitution, and drugs. Going legitimate when he assumed control of the Montreal-based Seagram Distillery, Sam forged links with the New York crime syndicate headed by another Russian Jew, Meyer Lansky, and during Prohibition supplied and thus controlled the spigot of liquor funneled into the United States and distributed by the Lansky mob. In many border towns in the northern U.S., there are family fortunes accumulated by locals who were part of the Bronfman network. And in the big cities, a connection with the syndicate was a must. in Detroit, the, quote, little Jewish Navy, unquote, of Morris Dalitz, later Lansky's top man in Las Vegas, ferried Bronfman booze into the U.S. Even Chicago's celebrated Italian-American gangster Al Capone owed his rise to his own Bronfman connection. It was Lansky who set Capone into Chicago from New York in the first place and assigned him to work for Johnny Torrio, Bronfman's Chicago contact, who was moving to unseat Big Jim Colissimo as Italian-American mafia chief in the Windy City. Colissimo had alienated Lansky and Bronfman, whom he called dirty Jews, by asserting there was no future in bootlegging. Showing little interest in patronizing Bronfman liquor and preferring to focus on drugs, prostitution, and even loan sharking. So then a Jewish hitman from New York retired Big Jim, and soon enough, Bronfman liquor flowed into Chicago. The media lionized Capone, but the Chicago mob, henceforward, was dominated by behind-the-scenes Jewish bosses. So that's our guy, Edgar Bronfman. Okay, and then if we go to the next slide here. Here's a guy we're all familiar with, Jack Ruby. So this is from page 234 of Final Judgment. Ruby and the Bronfman family. Jack Ruby's covert activities were clearly well established, but independent researcher Brian Downing Quigg came up with a Ruby connection that had never before been revealed. Exploring the corrupt world of Arizona mob, bagman, and political boss Kemper Marley, linked to the infamous 1976 murder of investigative reporter Don Bowles, Quigg learned from Marley's longtime publicist, Al Lizanets, that not only had Lansky linked Bronfman bootlegging, linked Bronfman bootlegging family been Marley's sponsors, but also that Jack Ruby himself was on the Bronfman family's payroll. So when we consider the Bronfman family's intimate ties to the Prim Index entity that clearly played a central role in the JFK conspiracy, the Ruby connection to the Bronfman family is interesting indeed, and does indeed point further to an Israeli connection. Okay, and then next slide here, Chance. We've just got a couple left. And here's another slide from our guy, Smolico. It is interesting but not surprising to note that in all the words written and uttered about the Kennedy assassination, Israel's intelligence agency, the Mossad, has never been mentioned. And yet a Mossad motive is obvious. On this question, as on almost all others, American reporters and commentators cannot bring themselves to cast Israel in an unfavorable light, despite the obvious fact that Mossad complicity is as plausible as any of the other theories. And that's a quote from former Rep. Paul Findlay in the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs from March 1992. So he was talking about Mossad back in the early 90s, and very few were talking about it then. And then you can go to the next one, Chance. Okay, I came across this last night. I thought this was rather interesting. Operation Haman is said to be the code name for the Mossad planned conspiracy to kill American President Kennedy. Named after Haman, the ancient Amalekite conspirator who desired the destruction of the Jewish people. That code name would be as reasonable as any, considering that Ben-Gurion's hatred for Kennedy, a modern-day Haman in Ben-Gurion's eyes.
May I say, that is one of Robert Grodin's fake color photographs. That's not an authentic JFK photograph. Grodin promotes it as though it were. It is not. That's a fake. Now, the left, it's interesting to be looking at the right ear there, because there's reason to think that right ear was severely damaged when the frangibular exploding bullet went off, and that it was that Liggett, the surgeon who was so skilled with a scalpel, reconstructed it. That ear there doesn't look like a normal ear, does it? I dare say Larry if you were to do a comparison of a JFK right here with this, it would be very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a fake color photograph with which Robert Grodin is associated.
Yeah.
We did a big deconstruction of this photograph a few shows back with Robert Morningstar. And the Men Who Killed Kennedy, and I don't forget the guy's name, he did the image processing on all the images. And I think he said that ear that we see there is actually mortician's wax, I think.
See, that would be consistent with Leggett recreate. You're talking about Tom Wilson, are you?
Yes, yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it.
I think that was the one with Morningstar you're talking about is one I missed, I think.
It may have been, yeah.
That's good. Wasn't that the second show with Morningstar?
Yeah, that might have been.
Yeah.
Okay, and then I got one more slide, Chance.
It's very troubling how many fake aspects of JFK Robert Grodin is associated with.
Yeah.
He still maintains that the Zapruder film is authentic, which is at this point in time simply absurd. He, of course, was a consultant to the HSCA arguing that the shirt that Billy Lovelady had been wearing was a better match to the doorman shirt than Oswald's shirt, which is another manifest absurdity. And, you know, go on from there. I mean, it's very embarrassing. Here you have a color photograph from the assassination that's a fake. Very embarrassing. Robert Grodin, very embarrassing. An embarrassment.
Well, Jim, I think you said it very, very well, I think, this morning in an email where Grodin has been responsible for continuing to support two of the most already discredited things about the JFK assassination, which are the motorcade having stopped, and which he says that the Zapruder film is authentic and that the motorcade continued on, and The Man in the Doorway, which are two of the main issues right now that have already been clarified and that he continues to support and which are indefensible as far as we are concerned.
And what's the point of Judith organizing a conference where issues like this, the most important developments in the last 10 years, are not even mentioned, much less discussed? I mean, it's outrageous to me.
Yeah, I'm not so sure it is. Judy's the one putting it together. What it really appears to me is more of a book fair. I'm not sure if I answered your question last time, but you were saying, was there an organizational principle to the conference? And I thought about it, and the answer is no. It appears if you have a book to sell, and then you can be there.
Well, are these books that Chris Mulligan has published?
It appears to be that way.
Did he publish Joan Mellon? Did Trine Day publish Joan Mellon?
I don't think. I'll have to look into that. But
having Joan Mellon in this mix is just outrageous to me. I mean, she's a perverter. She's a fraud. She's a phony. She came to Washington, completely subverted a very important conference. Had it not been for her presence, that might have made a difference here.
Yeah. But I do think they're primarily books published by Chris Mulligan.
So, yeah, the last slide here, I will just get this in, and then you guys can have the floor. So the government's handling of the investigation of John Kennedy's murder was a fraud. It was the greatest fraud in the history of our country. It was probably the greatest fraud ever perpetrated in the history of humankind. It doesn't mean that we have to accept the continued existence of the kind of government which allows this to happen. We can do something about it. We're forced to either leave this country or accept the authoritarianism that has developed. The authoritarianism, which tells us that in the year 2029, we can see the evidence of what happened to John Kennedy. And that's a quote from Jim Garrison.
Long gone.
At the closing speech.
That just shows what a magnificent guy this was. And, of course, he was talking about the Warren Commission having sealed the records for 75 years.
Yep.
Which, of course, corresponds to the average lifetime of American citizens. So it was intended none of this would be released during the lifetime of anyone who'd been around during when the assassination actually took place. Jim Garrison was a magnificent human being. It disturbs me profoundly that someone like Jim DiEugenio is riding on the coattails of Jim Garrison when Jim DiEugenio is now performing perfidy. He's betraying Jim Garrison's legacy when he claims to be, preserving it. It's an outrage.
Well, Well, that's Joan Mellon's, that's kind of her modus operandi as well.
Don, didn't you kind of say that Jim Garrison's office was heavily infiltrated and she walks around with her picture in Jim Garrison's office?
Yeah, I think that's what Joan Mellon's true role really was an infiltrator.
Well, not only that, Jim Garrison issued many subpoenas and extradition requests that were totally denied by governors throughout the U.S.
First time in American history, Larry.
That's right. Not only was his office completely infiltrated, but he had this guy by the name of Walter Sheridan, who came into New Orleans specifically to overturn and sabotage his investigation,
buy off witnesses, pay them off,
and he couldn't get Oswald's tax records.
How absurd is that? The government of the United States can't get the tax records of the alleged assassin of the president of the United States. Give me a break.
You just can't see him.
Garrison
attracted some of the top researchers at the time, like Harold Weisberg, Vincent Salandria, Mark Lane. All these people flocked to New Orleans to offer Garrison a lot of their own investigations and a lot of their work that had been done up to that point.
I was going to say that the Garrison couldn't get the tax records. That was denied on grounds of national security.
Yeah, national security, because they would have shown that he was working as an informant for the FBI with informant number 179, and he was receiving $200 a month right up to the time of the assassination. How often do you think an informant for the FBI is going to participate in the killing of a government official?
Yeah, I think the real national security they were worried about there was Israel. You know, I think the United States would have made it, you know, if Oswald's tax records had gone out, our country, yeah, there might have been some hubbub, but, you know, we would have kept going as a nation. But if it would have gone out in the public eventually, and I think that's, you know,
how were the tax records related to Israel?
Well, I think what would have happened was, because Garrison was getting pretty close to blowing the lid off of all of this stuff. And I think if Garrison would have gotten on a roll where they would have exposed Oswald is being a government op, you know, going, well, of course he was. How do you go to Russia and then come back with a wife, you know, in the late 50s, early 60s? I mean, come on, that's right there. And the State Department gives him money on the way back.
You have to realize America's future was not at stake here, but no. Israel's future
was.
Yeah,
if it would have gotten out, look at all these connections back to Israel. You know, we're talking about Tibor Rosenbaum, Edgar Bronfman, you know, Louis M. Bloomfield, Clay Shaw. I mean, if all this stuff would have come out, you can just see that Clay Shaw.
Einstein, Meyer Lansky.
Yep. Yeah, all of that business. If that would have hit the, you know, not that it would have hit the Jewish newspapers back then, but I mean, if any of that would have.
Guy Bannister was primarily running guns to Israel.
And see, and that's what Lyndon Johnson was doing back in the 30s. He was running guns to Israel.
Hey Don, how does the Torbit document relate to all of this montage here with Permindex? Because most JFK assassination researchers are aware of this Torbit document, which was actually written by an attorney by the name of David Copeland. And he mentions Permindex. In fact, it's very important in all of his thesis here. Many people think the Torbit document was thrown out there as a smokescreen, you know, so to speak, to muddy up the waters there on the JFK assassination. Do you have anything about that?
Now, that is not something I've really spent much time looking at. Maybe for a future show, we can discuss that.
Yeah, a lot of they're intricately linked, both the Torbit document and Permindex, because it talks a lot about the Permindex and a lot of the players that you spoke about during this presentation. So it's worth taking a look at that.
Absolutely.
You bet. I'm very glad you did this, Don, because PermIndex does deserve such an up-close and personal investigation, and you've cracked the ice here, it seems to me.
Yeah, I've kind of what I did was I assembled some pieces because it is kind of a complex puzzle. So I kind of pieced together the stuff that helped me understand it the most.
Well, you know, Don, I think the most important thing is this cliche is follow the money. Okay.
Yes. So. Yes, that's exactly it. Who has the money? You know, if you take somebody out and get away with it, what's the first thing you're going to need?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
You got to pay
control of the media.
And PermIndex seems to have been hopscotching all over the world. You know, wherever you know they, burned their bridges. You know, they ended up, you know, like in Johannesburg, you know, in Montreal, France, you know, wherever. You know, so
they ended up in New Orleans, and they're still here.
Yeah, New Orleans, yeah.
And it's amazing how the World Trade Center seemed to be the providence of a lot of our problems. I mean, the World Trade Center in 9/11, World Trade Center in
JFK.
Their building. It's the CIA's building in your town.
Don, in the minute we have left, would you like to sum up the results of your inquiries into PermIndex?
Yeah, I think, okay, so if we look at the money people that were behind it, Bronfman, Rosenbaum, you know, Bloomfield, you know, these guys are financing the, you know, the gangster level and the intelligence level, you know, the Lansky and then all your Masada operatives like Shaw and, you know, various other players. So we can see the nexus there where the money people are financing the operational people.
Yeah, you know, I was going to mention this guy by the name of Gatlin was one of the bagmen. He used to take money back and forth, and he ended up being thrown out of a sixth floor of a hotel here in Puerto Rico. So,
nice point. Gary, you want to give us a wrap?
Yep. All right, gentlemen, it looks like all roads lead to the same place. We invite our listeners to come along and join with us as we delve into the PermIndex issue. We are by no means there ourselves, but we're doing the best we can to find out more about this most perplexing issue in JFK. I'd like to thank all you gentlemen for being 100% truthers. Thank you very much, Chance George in the Engineer's Chair. This has been JFK Show number 79. We'll see you next week.